Hello, this is Eileen, and I'm reading part two of the Decatur Herald and Review for Thursday, September 8th. We'll start off with the obituaries. Leora Johnson, Decatur, age 101. She was formerly of Shelbyville, and she passed away peacefully at 8:30 p.m. on Tuesday, August 30th, 2016. A private family funeral service will be held at 1:30 on Sunday, September 11th, 2016, at the Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Shelbyville. There will be no visitation. Burial will be at the Glenwood Cemetery in Shelbyville. In Decatur, Dennis Lewis Jossis, 62, of Decatur, passed away to went to be with the Lord and Savior at 1:15 a.m. Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. Dennis donated his body to science so memorials may be made to the Central Illinois Cancer Care Specialists or St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. There are no further funeral announcements in the article. Norbert B. Holthaus, 63, of Nokomis, Illinois, passed away on Tuesday, September 6, 2016, at 9 a.m. at Pena Community Hospital in Pena. A Mass of Christian Burial will be held Friday, September 9, 2016, at 11 a.m. at St. Louis Catholic Church in Nokomis, Illinois. Visitation will be held at 10 a.m. until the service time at the church. Burial will be in the Sacred Heart Cemetery in Oconee, sorry, Illinois. Military rites by the Oconee American Legion will be given. Style Dawson Funeral Home in Nokomis is in charge of the arrangements. Memorials are suggested to St. Louis Church or St. Louis Church of Nokomis. Gary Lynn Byers, 59, of Decatur, departed this life on Saturday, September 3rd, 2016, at St. Mary's. Services celebrating his life will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, September 10th, at Community Temple Church of God in Christ at 759 South Jackson Street, with Bishop Donald Biggs officiating. Visitation is 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Professional services entrusted to Walker Funeral Services. Donald Henry Vance, 81, of Decatur, died at 10:21 a.m. Tuesday, September 6, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital. Funeral services to celebrate Don's life will be at 11 a.m. Friday, September 9th. At the Forsyth Unity United Methodist Church at 210 Rule Street in Forsyth, with Pastor Andy Maxwell officiating. Visitation will be 1 hour before the service time at the church. A private burial will be at Camp Butler National Cemetery in Riverton, Illinois. Next is John Michael Cambruzzi, 59, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away on Tuesday, September 6th, 2016, in his home surrounded by his family. Memorial services will be held at 3 o'clock Friday, September 9th, at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, with memorial visitation from 2 p.m. until service time. Dorothy Virginia Ridlin, 95, of Decatur, passed away on Monday, September 5th, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral services to celebrate Dorothy's life will be at 11 a.m. Friday, September 9th, in Morin Goebel Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday in the funeral home. Burial will be at the Macon County Memorial Park. Next is Maddie Mary Quick, 71, of Decatur, passed away at 12:59 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at St. Mary's Hospital. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, September 9th, 2016, at McMullen Young Funeral Home, Lovington, in Lovington. Visitation will be held 1 hour before the services at the funeral home in Lovington. Burial will be in the Turner Cemetery, Lovington. Memorials may be made in care of the family. Next is Walter Jr. Walt Scott, age 78, of Casey, Illinois, passed away at 11:58 a.m. on Monday, September 5th, 2016, at his home surrounded by his family. At his request, private family services will be conducted. Interment will be held at the Washington Street Cemetery in Casey, Illinois, at a later date. Memorial donations may be made to the Illinois ASA Hall of Fame Museum, P.O. Box 92, Casey, Illinois, 62420. Donald Henry Vance, 81, of Decatur, died at 10:21 a.m. Tuesday, September 6, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital. Funeral services to celebrate Don's life will be at 11 o'clock Friday, September 9th, at the Forsyth United Methodist Church at 210 Rule Street in Forsyth. And Michael D. Paris, 61, from Oklahoma, formerly of Decatur, died August 27, 2016. Services will be at 2 p.m. Saturday at the Maureen Goebel Funeral Home. Visitations 1 hour before the service. Private burial will be at a later date. Our next article is Report, Foot Chases Factor in Many Chicago Police Shootings. This is from Chicago. A newspaper's analysis of Chicago's police shootings from 2010 through 2015 found that foot chases played a role in more than a third of the 235 cases that ended with someone wounded or killed. About half of the pursuits began as police attempted to stop or question people for curfew violations, public drinking, thefts, disturbance calls, or minor offenses, the Chicago Tribune reported. According to the analysis, nearly a quarter of those killed by police during foot chases were struck only in the back, a factor that is often cited later in civil rights lawsuits that question the threat actually posed to officers. Those factors played out in the Chicago Police Department's recent fatal shooting of Paul O'Neill, an unarmed black teen who was killed in July after bailing out of a stolen car and leading officers on a foot chase in the city's south side. The newspaper's analysis also found that police say they recovered a gun in 84% of the shootings by officers involved in foot pursuits. I don't know if we would be respected or effective if we stopped chasing bad guys, said Anthony Guglielmi, a police spokesman from Chicago. Changes in how and when officers are permitted to chase suspects on foot will likely be an outcome of the U.S. Justice Department's ongoing probe into the Chicago Police Department, police experts say. At least a dozen Justice Department probes of police departments over the past 20 years have called for establishing specific foot chase guidelines. Other cities also have implemented police following controversial police shootings involving foot pursuits. Some experts said setting foot chase guidelines doesn't mean letting criminals loose. It's a false choice to say an officer has unlimited ability to pursue subjects or we just let the bad guys go, said Matthew Barg, co-executive director of the Policeman Assessment Resource Center, which has helped create and track policing reforms in cities across the country. Chicago Fraternal Order of Police President Dean Angelo Sr. said trying to micromanage officers' quick decisions could do more harm than good. If there's a foot chase policy, then the police officer has to call it in. It's got to be monitored, Angelo said. They're going to want to know why you're chasing him. To have to get into, well, is this justified under policy? with someone listening on the other end and deciding if you can continue, that would be crazy. The experts said federal investigators will be particularly interested in how police shootings have affected minorities. The newspaper's analysis found that while African Americans made up 80% of all those shot by police in the 6-year span, 94% of those shot were during foot chases were black. The Chicago Police Department released the data on officer shootings to the Chicago Tribune in July after the newspaper threatened to sue in the midst of a 7-month battle with the city over its failure to fulfill public record requests. This next article is from the National News. AP News breaks: Yosemite adding 400 acres of meadow forest, from Fresno, California. Visitors to the Yosemite National Park will soon have more and room to roam after officials on Wednesday announced a 400-acre expansion, the largest in nearly 70 years. The addition to the park in California features wetlands and grassy meadow surrounded by tall pine trees on rolling hills that are home to endangered wildlife. Ackerson Meadow is located along Yosemite's western boundary. The area was purchased from private owners by the Trust for Public Land, a nonprofit conservation group, for $2.3 million and donated to the park. Officials told the Associated Press that Yosemite will preserve the land, historically used for logging and cattle grazing, as habitat for wildlife such as the great gray owl, the largest owl in North America, and listed as endangered by California wildlife officials. Robin and Nancy Wainwright, who owned the land since 2006, sold it to the trust. Robin Wainwright said they lost a few $100,000 selling to the trust, and the couple also passed up a lucrative offer from a developer to build a resort. He said he often saw bear strolling through the meadow, and owls soaring over fields of vibrant wildflowers blooming in the springtime. He didn't want that experience available only to those who could afford a resort. To have that accessible to everyone, to me, is just the great thing, Wainwright said. It was worth losing a bit of the money for that. Sean Crook, president of the Tulum County Farm Bureau, said that not everybody supported turning the private property over to the government. For at least a century, the grassy Ackerson Meadow has fattened beef cattle and been used for logging, he said. That will no longer happen, he said, adding that both industries are being squeezed out of business. I fear we'll lose the value of that meadow. The park's boundary has seen some minor changes over the years, but this expansion is the largest since 1949, and the park of nearly 750,000 acres total, park spokesman Scott Gedeman said. More than 4.5 million people are expected to visit Yosemite this year, which Gedeman said would set a record for the park that celebrated its 125th anniversary in 2015. Other draws to the park include a massive half-dome rock and a sheer granite face of the El Capitan, both admired by visitors from the floor of the Yosemite Valley. Elsewhere in the park stand groves of giant sequoia, some of the oldest and largest living things on Earth. Visitors pass Ackerson Meadow on their way to the Hetchy Reservoir, which provides drinking water to San Francisco. The land was bought with $1.53 million from the Trust for Public Land and $520,000 from the Yosemite Conservancy, which supports a variety of projects in the park. Anonymous donors contributed the rest, Gedeman said. We are delighted and proud to make this gift to Yosemite and the people of America, said Will Rogers, president of the Trust for Public Land. The land completes the park's original plans from 1890, which included Ackerson Meadow, said Yosemite Conservancy's President Frank Dean. It's a stunning open meadow surrounded by forest habitat, which supports a wide variety of flora and fauna, said the park superintendent Don Neubacher. This next article is a national news also. The USGS upgrading Oklahoma earthquake to 5.8 magnitude from Oklahoma City. Two earthquakes this year in Oklahoma greater than magnitude 5.0, including a record-setting quake last weekend that damaged more than a dozen buildings, are expected to increase the likelihood of a more violent quake in the future, a top earthquake researcher said Wednesday. The earthquake, centered in the northeast part of Oklahoma on Saturday, was upgraded to a magnitude of 5.8 by the U.S. Geological Survey on Wednesday, making it the most powerful earthquake ever recorded in the state. It was the second quake exceeding magnitude 5.0 recorded in Oklahoma this year, which likely will increase the chance of a more powerful quake to come, the USGS geophysicist Daniel McNair said. We've had two fives this year, which means a lot more energy, McNamara said during a break in the seismicity workshop in Norman that attracted some of the top earthquake researchers from across the country. A 5.1 magnitude quake was reported in February near the town of Fairview in northwest Oklahoma. The previous strongest recorded quake in Oklahoma was a 5.6 magnitude trembler in 2011, which also was upgraded Wednesday to a 5.7 magnitude quake. The revisions were based on further analysis of recordings of seismic activity, the USGS said in its statement. One man suffered a minor head injury in Saturday's quake when part of a fireplace fell on him, and emergency management officials said there have been reports of damage to more than a dozen buildings. The uptick in earthquakes in Oklahoma over the last 5 years has been linked to the high-pressure injection of oil and gas wastewater deep underground, although researchers say it's too early to tell what may have caused Saturday's quake, which was located much further east than most of the previous quakes in Oklahoma. I'm a little surprised to see a really large earthquake on the fringes of our earthquake area of interest, said Jeremy Boak, the director of Oklahoma Geological Survey. It could be a natural earthquake. It could be some injection wells nearby. It could be the regional pattern of injection. Another possibility, Boak said, is that a pulse of high water pressure deep underground has slowly moved eastward until it hit a natural fault that was queued up and ready and had enough seismic energy that once triggered, it really let go of a big one. As a result of the increase in seismic activity in Oklahoma, state oil and gas regulators have ordered hundreds of disposal wells to either shut down or reduce the amount of wastewater they are injecting. About 54 wells in the 725 square mile area near Saturday's quake were ordered shut down by state and federal regulators. In early 2015, state regulators said the amount of disposed wastewater was decreased by about 800,000 barrels a day, a roughly 25% decrease from the 2014 levels. Boak said the reduction in the wastewater disposal appears to be producing the desired effect, dropping the number of quakes 3.0 and larger from 907 in 2015 to 472 this year through September 4th. Still, both Boak and McNamara say the possibility exists that a quake as large as 6.0 could rattle Oklahoma sometime in the future. That's what we worry about, McNamara said. There are definitely faults in Oklahoma big enough to produce that size of a rupture. This article from New York, titled "Trump, U.S. Generals Reduced to Rubble, He'd Replace Some." Leveling unusually harsh criticism against the military, Republican Donald Trump said Wednesday night that American generals have been reduced to rubble under President Barack Obama and suggested he would fire some of them if he wins the presidency in November. Trump's comments came during the NBC Commander-in-Chief Forum at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum aboard the decommissioned aircraft carrier Intrepid on Wednesday in New York. In the televised National Security Forum, he and Democratic rival Hillary Clinton each fielded 30 minutes of questions about their experience and judgment to be commander-in-chief. While the candidates never appeared on stage together, their back-to-back sessions served as a preview of sorts for their upcoming debates. By virtue of a coin flip, Clinton took the stage first and quickly found herself responding at length to questions about her years in government. She reiterated that she had made mistakes in relying on a personal email account and private server as Secretary of State and in voting for the 2003 invasion of Iraq as a senator. But she defended her support for U.S. military intervention to help oust dictator in Libya despite the chaotic aftermath. "I'm asking to be judged on the totality of my record," said Clinton, who grew visibly irritated at times with the repeated focus on her past actions. Clinton, who has cast Trump as a dangerously ill-prepared commander-in-chief to be, tried to center the discussion on her foreign policy proposals should she win in November. She vowed to not send American ground troops into Iraq or Syria to fight the Islamic State group. And she pledged to hold weekly Oval Office meetings with representatives from the Pentagon and Department of Veterans Affairs to stay abreast of health care for veterans. Trump did little to counter the criticism that he lacks detailed policy proposals, particularly regarding the Islamic State. He both insisted he has a private blueprint for defeating the extremist group and that he would demand a plan from military leaders within 30 days of taking office. Asked to square his request for military options with his harsh criticism of the current crop of generals, Trump said simply, "There'll probably be different generals." Trump renewed his praise of Russian President Vladimir Putin for having great control over his country. He stood by previous comment that appeared to blame military sexual assaults on men and women serving together, but added he would not seek to remove women from the military. And for the first time, he opened the door to granting legal status to people living in the U.S. illegally who joined the military. "I think that when you serve in the armed forces, that's a very special situation," Trump said, "and I could see myself working that out." As a businessman with no substantial national security experience, Trump was vague about how he is preparing for the enormous array of complex issues that would land on his desk as commander-in-chief. He cited his team of military advisors, but also said he has a common sense that will help him make decisions on foreign policy. With just 2 months until Election Day, national security has emerged as a centerpiece issue in the White House race. Both candidates believe they have the upper hand, with Clinton contrasting her experience with Trump's unpredictability and the Republican arguing that Americans worried about their safety will be left with more of the same if they elect Obama's former Secretary of State. While GOP candidates are often seen by voters as having an advantage on military and national security issues, Trump is far from the traditional Republican. He has no military experience and has repeatedly criticized the skill of the armed forces. A flood of Republican national security experts have instead chosen to back Clinton, helping bolster her case that Trump is broadly unacceptable. Earlier Wednesday, former Defense Secretary William Cohen joined the list of GOP officials supporting Clinton. Ahead of the forum, Trump rolled out the new plan to boost military spending by tens of billions of dollars, including major increases in the number of active troops, fighter planes, ships, and submarines. His address earlier in the day also included plans to eliminate deep spending cuts known as the sequester that were enacted when Congress failed to reach a budget compromise in 2011. Republicans and Democrats voted for the automatic across-the-board cuts that affected both military and domestic programs, though the White House has long pressed Congress to lift the spending limits. Trump expressed support for the sequester in interviews in 2013, even describing them as too small, but seemed to suggest at the time that military spending should be exempt. A senior advisor said ahead of the speech that Trump would make sure the additional spending was fully paid for, but did not explain how. The United States currently spends more than $600 billion a year on the military, more than the next seven countries combined. And now this article, Green Party's Jill Stein charged with trespassing mischief from Mandan, North Dakota. A North Dakota judge issued a warrant Wednesday for the arrest of Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who is accused of spray painting construction equipment during a protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Court records show that Stein was charged Wednesday in Morgan County with a misdemeanor count of criminal trespass and criminal mischief. The same charges have been filed against her running mate, Ahuma Baraka. Stein campaign spokesman Melissa Figueroa could not immediately comment on whether Stein plans to turn herself in. Activists invited Stein to leave a message at the protest site near the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's reservation on Tuesday, Figueroa said, and Stein sprayed, "I approve this message," in red paint on a blade of a bulldozer. A court document shows Baraka painted the word decolonization on the piece of construction equipment. Morton County Sheriff's spokesman Rob Keller said the warrant has been filed, and if authorities were to come across Stein, they'd arrest her. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is trying to stop construction of a section of a $3.8 million four-state pipeline the tribal leaders say would violate sacred and culturally sensitive grounds and possibly pollute water. Before the charges were filed, Stein said in a statement, she hoped the North Dakota authorities press charges against the real vandalism taking place in Standing Rock Reservation, the bulldozing of the sacred burial site, and the unleashing of vicious attack dogs. Well, that's it for today. This has been Eileen with the Decatur Herald and Review for Thursday, October 8th. Have a good day.